morning. Be seated, please. Justice Douglas will be arriving a little late. He has read the briefs and he will be participating in the decisions in the cases we hear this morning. The first case is 96-2029, 96-2509, State of Ohio versus Maxwell White. Mr. Bodine.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve the time I have remaining for my lead argument. Maxwell White was convicted and sentenced to death by a jury comprised of 11 impartial people. One individual who on at least 10 occasions indicated that she could not be fair because she had formed an opinion about Max White's guilt based upon news and television reports. Juror Shepherd was challenged for cause twice. She was never independently blundered by the trial court, and in the final analysis, informed the court that although she thought it would be easy to get out of jury duty because of her opinion about Max White's guilt, she was nonetheless a member of the Ashland County community and wanted to participate in Mr. White's punishment.
Counsel, did the objection for cause remain to the end of the set withdrawn?
There were two challenges for cause, Your Honor. One was withdrawn after there were three questions by defense counsel. It was, however, resurrected after the voir dire moved into what should have been solely the Witherspoon analysis. At that point, Juror Shepherd revisited her concerns about her ability to be fair based upon her prior opinion. So the challenge for cause was resurrected. It did remain until the end of the voir dire and was ultimately overruled by the trial judge. The first challenge for cause was never ruled upon. It was withdrawn before the trial court ruled on the motion. So by the end of the voir dire, the challenge for cause did exist. And defense counsel used all of their peremptory challenges. There were six peremptory challenges, Your Honor. There were two remaining for the ultimate. All six were used on the panel, and all remained to all six.
So there were six other people whose minds were even more hopelessly made up than
this. Possibly. What's interesting about those other six jurors, Juror Bates, Cunningham, Jones, Fortune, most of those jurors never went anywhere near as far as Juror Shepherd did in telling the trial court about their impartiality. It was either they had talked about the case to friends, as in the case of their Fortune, or simply articulated that they weren't sure that they could be fair or not.
So then, arguably, at least, or at least possibly, in trial counsel's mind, there was something about this woman that caused trial counsel to decide even Woodby's responses, this prospective juror is potentially better for my client than some of these other jurors that were challenging. They had heard some news accounts or something of that nature.
That's correct, Your Honor. The record obviously doesn't reflect trial counsel's opinion about the juror. In assessing challenges to a jury under the Sixth Amendment analysis.
But reading the cold record, you can certainly find somebody else in your view to keep and excuse this juror.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. The reason we impanel a special veneer capital for our guests is a whole room full of people, none of whom articulated any bias or any concerns based upon
the brief. But I mean, of the six challenges, and just reading the cold record, your response would be whether two or three others I would have found acceptable.
I certainly would have, Your Honor. However,
versus this one.
Exactly. But not being in the trial situation, and again, we don't invade the province of the peremptory challenge on appellate review. There is no way to evaluate what defense counsel thought of those remaining jurors. While there is a good basis to evaluate the tenor, the demeanor, and the credibility of Juror Shepherd because of the extensiveness of the comments.
had all the peremptory challenges been used before counsel had an opportunity to talk with this juror that we're discussing?
No, Your Honor. The voir dire was in the first place completed before peremptory challenges were exercised, and it does appear on the face of the record that Juror Shepherd was seated during that.
Counsel had an opportunity to talk with the juror in question, and that no peremptories had been exercised at the time that her voir dire questioning was over.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So when she seated in there in the first 12, was she?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that they were accepted for cause, were they?
The challenges for cause were issued as the jurors were individually voir dire. In other words, they didn't complete voir dire and then causes for challenge were exercised.
What was the status of the record as far as challenges for cause just before the peremptory challenge phase came in?
All the challenges for cause had been issued individually to each juror, and the other were granted not. There were no additional challenges on her after the practice.
Was she one of the 12 then?
Yes, she was
so
on the panel.
That she was in the panel, and counsel had an opportunity then to exercise a peremptory with her being there.
That's correct.
And he chose not to.
The analysis this court must undertake, however, does not look at what defense counsel did with their peremptory challenges. As I said, they never invade the province of the peremptory challenge. When the challenge for cause is made, in this case twice, to the trial court, it is the trial court's obligation to challenge a juror who legitimately, on the basis of the record, indicates that she is impartial.
But the better argument for you to bring forward would be that, Your Honor, all my challenges for cause have been used. I just now have found out through questioning of this person who has been seated in the jury that there is certainly a challenge for cause, and I think that you would have a better argument if you didn't have any peremptories left, and that your only way to get this juror off the jury as for cause, wouldn't you?
I would certainly like to be able to make that argument to Your Honor, but I'm confined by the record. And the fact is that Juror Shepherd, there was a possibility for her to be challenged with a peremptory challenge. But again, that's not the standard of this court or the United States Supreme Court. It's ever defined evaluating the fairness or the bias of individual jurors. It is the trial court's obligation in the first instance. If there is a basis for a challenge of cause, that juror must be struck. You do not limit the defense's use of their peremptory challenges.
Were all the peremptory challenges used?
Yes, Your Honor. There were all eight.
So there could have been other jurors that the defense counsel wanted to use the peremptory on. The argument would be stronger. Peremptories left, and this juror was left on them, and they wouldn't be.
If there had been peremptories left and they were not executed, then I would not be arguing this.
That's right.
Your court, this court, has been absolutely clear in Taylor and in future cases that trial counsel must, in fact, exercise all the peremptory challenges. What's important about this case is the extensive and I think the honesty that Juror Shepherd came forward with her bias. Very early on in the voir dire, she indicated.
Mr. Bodine, may I interrupt again? We read it, and it seems that, as you'll acknowledge and you do, that she equivocates back and forth, which we know this happens with the right posing of questions, the right tone. Jurors tend to respond, you know, in the way that they're led. And so this juror always ends up back at, well, yes, I can do it. And your point is, nevertheless, all the equivocation amounts to cause. But my question relates to the standard in that we have a juror who's equivocated. And the challenge here is that she could not be impartial as to guilt because you're really not challenging her being death biased. At least your proposition law doesn't say that. And we have a case here where guilt was essentially, I mean, the defense put on no witnesses as in the guilt phase. So, as I get it, they essentially laid down on the guilt. And so that's, what's, is there prejudice? Do we have to have some prejudice here in the guilt phase?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the United States Supreme Court concludes the evaluation of President. Three answers to your question, actually. In the first instance, there was an all-sale defense agreement on guilt. Certainly that the killing had occurred. But defense counsel throughout the voir dire went to great lengths to explain, especially to Judge Shepard, that there are varying levels of culpability, and that's what we're dealing with. Secondly, you never look at a prejudice component or even whether or not there is a complete understanding that guilt exists before the trial. In fact, in Georgia against Waller, addressing specifically Sixth Amendment principles, the United States Supreme Court held that the jury panel must be fair and impartial, even if they're not quoting now, there is no question about the defendant's guilt. The Sixth Amendment principle is inviolate. It is a structural defect, as identified by Arizona against Fulminante. If there is one unfair juror, the inquiry ends, regardless of whether any 12 people would have convicted the individual.
Where the, as here we have a juror who equivocates, who makes that call? Is it our call? Because we're not there.
You can't properly make that call. Two problems, if I may again. What this court has said in State against Allen, in State against Wilson, and certainly the United States Supreme Court in case even Patton, upon which the state relies, when there's sufficient evidence on the record that calls into question our legitimate objection to a juror, that an appellate court is in a position to evaluate the tenor demeanor of the juror's responses. Again, State against Palmer, this court's century-old case authority, states that we must go beyond what even the trial court the second point, Your Honor, I take issue with the notion that there was equivocation on behalf of this juror. What we typically see are leading questions by the state, even the defense, that engendered simple yes or no answers. Juror Shepard did that very rarely. Even response to the state's questions, can you be fair, can you try to follow the law? She continually said, I'm going to try to do that. If it related to evidence, she said, yes, I understand what you're saying, but I think it's going to be the same evidence that I already know about. Toward the end of the voir dire, the most telling statements, again, in response to what normally are considered leading questions, she went far beyond any other juror's answer, saying that I believe he's guilty. I thought that would be an easy out, but I'm a member of this community. I want to participate in this punishment. In response to the simple questions, can you follow the court's instructions? Like I stated, I feel like to do this, but yet again, I have doubt that I couldn't. So I don't think that there were any unequivocal answers about fairness and impartiality like this court has seen in cases like Lundgren and Wolf. Even Allen and Wilson, those jurors that came forward were at least stronger on their responses that they would try their best to be fair and set aside their opinions. What's interesting about the Allen decisions and Wilson in particular is what this court was convinced based on the record about those individual jurors. In Allen, a bare majority of this court found that it was the trial court's independent voir dire and the specific articulation on the record of the findings of why the individual juror was in fact capable of setting aside opinions. The trial court in Allen in particular explained to the juror that the frustration she had with her own brother's case didn't carry over into the courtroom, and she did express an understanding of that.
Counsel, is it clear from reading the record that when this prospective juror is saying, I know about this case, and is it clear that she's assessing the relevant statutes and the culpable mental state, or does it appear that what she's saying is, I know this trooper was shot, there doesn't seem to be much doubt that this defendant is the person who wielded the weapon, pulled the trigger, that resulted in the death of the trooper. Pretty much everybody in Ashland County would be aware of those facts. facts, and that would just be an honest and forthcoming statement. That isn't really what the trial was about. Those, as Justice Cook has pointed out, those bare bones facts were practically stipulated.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. I think what Juror Shepherd indicates throughout the trial is exactly what you're saying. I believe Max White's guilty of killing Officer Gross. I wouldn't normally expect any juror to understand the complexities of our bearing on levels of murder, but during the voir dire, Mr. Whitney went to great lengths, specifically pulling back at some point and saying, the question isn't simply whether a killing occurred, Mr. Shepherd. We have varying levels, and as he was explaining that to Juror Shepherd, she actually interrupted him during that call, page 83 of the record, and said, I'll be willing to listen to all this, but I feel too strong about this. So even if there is a question that she was only considering what may have been a general understanding of this crime, because defense counsel took that extra step, endeavored to explain different levels of culpability to her, and she still rejected it, then you can eliminate that concern that she was only talking in the broad sense of this crime.
Yeah, I mean, going to what Justice Sweeney, where Justice Sweeney was going, challenge for cause has now been rejected. This woman's in the box as part of the original 12 before defense counsel exercises even the first parameter. You've indicated there doesn't seem to be another juror on the face of the record who has come even close to expressing these kinds of reservations. Defense counsel is experienced counsel. Is this invited error?
So if it's invited error, Your Honor, it's invited by the trial courts. It's not the defendant's obligation to remedy those errors when they're properly put before the trial court judge. More importantly, we don't take away the effective use of the peremptory challenges from the defense. Those are essential to our trial process. All we should be looking at trial counsel is whether or not they independently and effectively voir dire this juror so the trial court could effectively evaluate her. Look to see whether trial counsel issued the challenge for cause, and then under this court's series of cases, an integrity exercise all of the parameter challenges. If that occurs, then under Allen and under Wilson, the only inquiry for this court is whether the statements of this juror indicate that she should have been challenged for cause. Under either statutory authority that applies here, sections 2313-42J, or its counterpart, 2313.43, if there is any doubt about a juror's impartiality, the cause challenge should be issued. And if there is any doubt that the juror is anything but entirely unbiased, the challenge cause should be issued. Interestingly,
what you're saying is that if it is a trial tactic on behalf of defense counsel, knowing or having good cause to know he has reversible error in the record, you're saying that the court cannot consider that trial tactic and the non-use of a peremptory challenge in deciding this question.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's nothing on the record to indicate.
Absolutely. I'm correct.
No court has ever said to invade the province of the peremptory challenge when the trial court has been issued the challenge for cause. What you're doing, in effect, is putting the obligation on the trial judge into the defense's lap. They've done everything that they could do. We don't know what Mr. Whitney thought when he looked at that panel. Certainly, there was a need to use all eight peremptory challenges, perhaps more. What we're suggesting now is not on the record that he intentionally held back on the peremptory challenge against Shepherd for this very reason. I mean, it's just as easy to take from this record the fact that he had developed a very good rapport with her, and more so than any other juror, at least was honest in her concern in telling the trial court, I understand what you want me to do, but I don't understand how I'm supposed to do that.
But didn't she ultimately say that she could be a fair and impartial juror, and that she, if she was on trial, that she would in fact like to have a person like herself as a juror?
She She certainly said she was honest, Your Honor, and her opinion would be the benchmark for having a jury assembled.
Now, I thought that the defense counsel withdrew his challenge to cause after that point when she made all those statements.
Very early on, Your Honor. In fact, again, there were about 4 questions posed by Mr. Whitney before the challenge to cause was withdrawn. It was renewed again. Here at 157 of the record, when Juror Shepard addressed the record, those concerns, at the point where she said, I know this doesn't completely feel fair, I know I can justify my feelings, but I have too much doubt, and I think for a person's life there should not be any doubt whatsoever.
That was at 157?
157, Your Honor.
Counsel, just your time is running low. I would like you to address the intoxication issue.
Your Honor, briefly, the intoxication instruction, it is a legitimate defense that may be raised by the defense in this instance. Our concern with the jury instruction was that it placed too high a burden on the defense, required them to provide evidence beyond a reasonable doubt as opposed to the preponderance of the evidence standard. And there was certainly throughout this trial voluminous testimony about Mr. White's intoxication or negligence, which does impact the prior conversation of the time. As it was, the way the instructions were read to the jury, they were first told that it was not an excuse. And then the only standard they were provided with was the reasonable doubt standard. So assuming that they didn't listen to the trial court and thought it might have been a legitimate excuse, they evaluated that evidence under a reasonable doubt standard, which effectively precluded any impact that the next day it had on the jury. And again, with all of those issues, because we do have the possibility of an impartial jury, I think that heightens Your Honor, on the whole, Mrs. Shepard's comment suggested bias predominant in quantity, specificity, and certainty, which was countered by relatively few general statements that she could follow instructions for.
Mr. Bodine, let me interrupt you to ask a question that doesn't directly apply to this case, but in view of the death penalty cases we've seen in which, as you've indicated, in which the prospective juror is tugged and pulled to answer the question about ability to be fair and impartial, and also usually a question about the death penalty, would we be well advised to consider only a rule that would provide that only the trial judge could ask those questions of prospective jurors in order to hopefully get a candid, forthright answer from a prospective juror without responding to questions from defense counsel and from the prosecutor?
I think it would be a good recommendation that the trial judges participate. On Illinois, in fact, because trial judge on the 12 years, which has been held past constitutional muster. The major concern that I would have there is the restriction on the scope of what here. So as long as there was a mechanism for the parties to pose the questions and have all the questions answered, I think you'd lose some necessarily good flavor in having the defense and the prosecution independently voir dire. Perhaps a better rule would be...
Well, but flavor isn't what we're looking for, is it? Aren't we looking for jurors who can be very forthright in their answers on those very difficult questions without having them have to respond to questions that are tainted or that are necessarily and appropriately designed to get a certain answer from them? These are death cases in which, not to tell you, they're important cases. And I guess I'm just concerned by the cases we've seen where we have this tug and pull, and we've asked people to come in and make very difficult decisions for us or help us make difficult decisions, and then we put them through this sort of ringer of, you answered this way, now let me ask you this way, and we go back and forth, and sometimes it's difficult, I think, to know what the juror really thinks, what their real attitude is. Obviously, the questions could be, the rule could be written, and I don't have a rule of mind, certainly, but I know there are states that do this. I'm just wondering whether we should design a rule that would permit counsel, obviously, to propose questions to the judge that counsel believe ought to be asked?
I would hesitate to go that far. What concerns me is whether or not the defense and the state could actually get to the root of their concerns with using the different jury, or whether they would want to hear so much from the trial court. But encouraging the trial courts to get involved, especially in a case like this, rather than just watching the tug and pull among the parties, would certainly benefit not only the evaluation of the discourse ability to review, and I emphasize again that Juror Shepherd was challenged for cause, and those parameters were all used, so this issue is properly preserved for error for review by this court. And in making its determination, I encourage the members of this court to be guided by Chief Justice Moyer's comments in stating Ms. Williams, in which she wrote, "This case represents a test for the criminal justice system. Because of the right to an impartial jury is not protected for the worst among us, it is guaranteed to none of us."
Thank you, Mr. Bourdain. Mr. DeSanto.
Mr. Chief Justice and other justices of the Supreme Court, I'm Robert DeSanto, the Jackson County Prosecutor. I tried this case with my Chief Assistant Prosecutor, Ramona Rogers. Before I argue any of these particular positions, I'd like to make four observations about this case that I think are important and permeate the entire appellate argument. First, this court has already recognized the issue of guilt as to who killed the trooper was overwhelming. No question about it, eyewitness testimony. The issue of was there the requisite intent, the prior calculation of design, was equally overwhelming. The defendant had indicated previously his intent to give trouble to the next officer that stopped him. He had used terms such as the next cop that stops him and cap his ass. He had the clarity of mind throughout the day, although intoxicated. He had the clarity of mind before the shooting to realize that his mother was going to call the police on him for probation violation. He recognized he had violated his probation. He was able to tear off the telephones of his home so his mother couldn't call the police, showing the clarity of mind. He was able to find his guns, load his guns, tie his mother to a pole so she couldn't, and his sister to a pole so they couldn't report him to the police. He was able to drive from Columbus to Ashland, Ohio without any apparent problem. And I thought significantly that when he packed his guns, they were long rifles and handguns. The one gun that he left out of the trunk was the handgun that he had on his lap. And there's no evidence in this record that that handgun was for any other purpose than to shoot a police officer that might try to stop him, which in fact happened. When he shot the officer, he shot him first and wounded him. But the clarity of purpose was further seen again when, as the officer ran and fled, he shot the officer in the back. The fact that he could hit the officer running away from him also shows, I think, the thinking mind. The other thing is in terms of, you have a flight, a mad chase from the scene of the accident, speeds over 100 miles an hour. I'm really slippery pavement, and he made it to Akron before he split off the road.
Counsel,
yes.
Would you do you intend to address the proposition of law that was argued primarily number one, the first proposition of law?
Okay. I do. The other thing that I think is important to understand is that in terms of the mitigation in this case, the mitigating events, there was nothing in this man's life that I think the jury would have found mitigating. If they find mitigating, it was very minimal, and his life was explored through the testimony. There was nothing in the circumstances of the crime itself that was mitigating. So I think that this case was overwhelming evidence in regards to the guilt phase as well as the sentencing phase. In regards to issue number one, and this is Shepard, the courts have said, and I think rightfully so, that great deference is given to the trial court who views and questions the jurors in question. Because many times, in fact, almost always, we have jurors who equivocate in answering the particular questions. as did Mrs. Shepherd in this case. When we read the full record, however, of what Mrs. Shepherd was asked and how she answered her questions, I think that is the most telling part of it. She does begin by saying she could not be fair. But then we learn, as she is going through this tug and pull process, we learn from her own words, "When I came in here, I thought it would be easy to get off this jury by saying, I know he's guilty." So we understand now we have a juror who did not want to sit on this jury. But she came to her civic responsibility through the tug and pull of that question. It is clear, I think, from the record, that this was a citizen that was bothered by the fact that she was going to try to skirt her duty. And from the questioning, we realized how important it was for the community that we have jurors, fair and independent jurors, that will sit on juries. Mr. Whitney, the defense counsel here, as I think one of the justices has said, is an experienced trial attorney. He was questioning her, and we can see the ebb and flow. But even he found early on, after he had raised his challenge for cause, through his questioning, he withdraws it. And then he goes further on in the guilt phase with his questioning. And Mrs. Shepherd says something else that raises that challenge up again. Now, in the end, I think it's important that we look at not how Mrs. Shepherd started, but how she ended up. And the four questions that preceded her sitting on that jury, she answered as follows. She would obey the law and the court's instruction. She would not let personal beliefs interfere with her decision. She would consider all facts, aggravating as well as mitigating. And she would listen with an open and unbiased mind. Now at that point, the judge overruled the motion to challenge the cause. And Mr. Whitney had the opportunity to utilize a peremptory challenge. And he did it. Now I would suggest to the jury, or to the judges here, that there are many times when you're voir dire a juror that you get a commitment from that juror to be fair. That might have started out to be maybe not a juror that you think would be favorable to you. But through your questioning, you have achieved a commitment from that personal juror that they would be fair. That you don't have that because you didn't perhaps inquire as deeply with the other jurors, you feel that there's that commitment. And Mr. Whitney very well may have felt that he had examined Mrs. Shepherd enough that he felt that she would be maybe extra careful to be fair to his client.
Counsel, whose obligation is it in trial to keep reversible error out of it?
Well, that obligation rests with the judge trying the case. But certainly the prosecutor does not want reversible error, and I would hope and think that the defense counsel does not want reversible error. And so I would say it's the obligation of all the court and the attorneys to make sure that doesn't happen.
You mean to say that defense counsel, whose obligation is to defend this client and to get him off if he can, has a duty to use a peremptory challenge if he feels that the court has made a serious mistake and has not granted a challenge for cause? You say that he is obligated to use a peremptory challenge if he has one left?
Well, I'm not saying it's obligated. I think the question is whose responsible to make sure there's not a reversible error. And I answered that I thought all the participants were. But at the point if a defense attorney in a capital case truly believes there was a prejudiced juror on that panel that would not only convict his client, but also vote for a death penalty, I think an obligation is to get that person off challenge that person on a peremptory challenge rather than leave the person on and risk. I mean, he may think it's reversible, but if it's not, he may just have left a juror on that would go to the death penalty for his client.
And I assume you further feel that the defense counsel, he has no duty to try to get reversible error into the case in behalf of his client?
I don't believe that the defense counsel has a duty or responsibility to get reversible error into the case. I may be wrong on that, but I don't believe that.
That's your opinion.
That's my opinion.
So then you feel that the defense counsel had an obligation to use the peremptory challenge on this potential juror?
No, I don't, because I think this potential juror was a fine juror for the defense. I am not willing to say that the evidence of the record here shows that this juror is an unbiased juror. In fact, I think she may have been more favorable to the defense because she has made such commitments to be fair and unbiased, as opposed to somebody who really didn't get questioned on it very much. I would cite the Supreme Court case of Patton versus Young, which I found to be enlightening, and it talks about the fact that the reviewing court should give great significance and deference to the trial court's decision in these matters. More importantly, I thought the footnote in that case, the courts recognized how this the inflections, the way, the flow of the conversation sometimes is more important than the context. And I would just, the court will permit me, just to read a paragraph here from Patton versus Young, where it says, the manner of jurors while testifying is oftentimes indicative of the real character of their opinion than are their own words. This is seen below in the trial, but cannot always be spread on the record. Care should therefore be taken in the reviewing court not to reverse the ruling below upon such questions of fact, except in a clear case. Any complicated voir dire calls upon laypersons to think and express themselves in unfamiliar terms, as a reading of any transcript of such proceedings will reveal. Demeanor, inflection, the flow of the questions and answers can make the confused and conflicting utterances comprehensive. And there, in that case, the Supreme Court was faced with, much like this case, a juror that seems to be flushing and perhaps ambiguous. And they found that, even though that juror was ambiguous, that was properly seen.
If we disagree with you, counsel, and find that this was a biased juror who ought to have been excused for cause, is that the end of our analysis? Is the case reversed?
I don't believe so.
You didn't argue this issue in your answer to Proposition of Law 1. You just argued the deferential standard that we ought to defer. But assuming that there is a point at which this court would differ, despite our deference to the trial court, where are we procedurally?
Well, this goes back, to the facts of this case where we have...
No, it's a legal question. I'm asking you a legal question, not a factual one.
I think that he was based on the
appellant cites Gray versus Mississippi.
Pardon?
The appellant cites Gray versus Mississippi, the U.S. case regarding the dismissal of a biased juror, the failure to dismiss. You didn't argue that, counsel, but have you thought about that?
Well, I thought about it in terms, I think that even if this... I think the court, the next analysis would then be to look at the case itself and to determine if the case was overwhelming in both the guilt and sentencing phase, as this case is.
That the Sixth Amendment right would be, that wouldn't be a fundamental right to a fair and impartial jury? That's what we're talking about here. Can it be non-prejudicial error?
I think that it can be non-prejudicial error, yes.
Do you have any cases?
I don't have a case for that.
Mr. DeSanto, in my absence, did you at all discuss whether or not there was a B3 factor in this case?
No, I did not discuss it in your absence.
Would you do that? The mental defect, or it seems to me that the defendant here is arguing that the trial judge was just plain confused and didn't know what was happening about the psychiatric evaluations. I guess my question is, does it rise to a level of a B3 mitigating factor, that is mental defect or disease, and should there have been a charge?
No, it doesn't. In fact, in this case, when I was examining the expert for the defense in the mitigating stage of this trial, the defense expert was Dr. Smith, and he had found that the defendant suffered from substance abuse disorder and systemic disorders, which is a form of depression. And I began to zero in on whether he felt that was a defect or disease because I had some indication that he felt that way. I was stopped in that line of questioning and brought up to the bench and I was stopped by the defense, at which point, and this is in the transcript of the record, the defense counsel, we are not raising the mental disease or defect mitigation, and that since it's not on the table, Mr. DeSanto cannot begin his cross-examination of Dr. Smith in that regard. I argued that it wasn't that all mitigating factors are on the table by a matter of law, but the court and the defense counsel said they didn't want me to go into that issue because they weren't raising it.
Well, if in fact there was a B3 question, and it was peripherally there, that's why you were cross-examining on it. If in fact it was there, it's your contention then that there's an absolute and unequivocal waiver?
Well, absolutely there was a waiver of that because it was prevented from going in. I think it was only raised by the law. In other words, it was a mitigating circumstance in the law. Until it's taken off the table and we're not going to go into that mitigation, the prosecution has to deal with it as though it may be play a factor in the case.
I don't think so. I think DePue says that unless they raise the mitigating factor, it's not in play, as you would put it.
Right. Well, the first witness they had on that witness stand was Dr. Smith, who was...
He raised it at least peripherally.
Do you care for me to discuss that further?
No, I wasn't sure. I didn't see in your brief where you said, where you argued absolute waiver of the B3, but that's an important factor, I think. Because that's, what else is there in mitigation other than that?
Well, I would argue that there is very little, if any.
That's why I went to that issue.
Counsel, coming back to the juror issue, did Judge Henderson excuse the juror's challenge for cause?
Yes, he did. In fact, when immediately proceeding overruling the motion for cause on Juror Shepard, four other jurors were excused for cause, and basically because they had indicated that they could not be fair and impartial in this particular matter.
Were they voir dired in front of each other, or were they respective jurors?
There were groups of them that were brought in, and those that were for that proceeded, Mrs. Shepard, were present, but Mrs. Shepard was voir dired. And not only did Mr. Whitney voir dire the jurors, but the court did a preliminary voir dire of these witnesses.
Were you about to exhaust your panel, or were there plenty of people still left?
There were sufficient people. We were moving in that direction. I don't want to say that there was considerable number, but we were moving in that direction because a number of them had been excused at the very start for personal reasons.
But I did not hear the defense counsel argue it's not a case where the trial judge starts tightening up his interpretation of what you should get off the cause because he's concerned that we're about to have to go out on the streets or send the sheriff out to...
That was not an issue.
And you exercised all of your peremptories?
I believe we did. I personal. I was the exact
your question before.
But from what you've argued here,
leave a potential.
It's your strong feeling
on a jury like this is stupid.
When it came to the Brantford side of this,
don't you think
that the defense counsel would be,
she would have been fine out
of what was a sandbag.
Well, that's a
strong by exercise. The Brantford was
with respect to the jurors to the big government to
leave this jury on the panel. That required me to make a judgment, and I would say, if you know, I've dealt with
only the justice of years,
and I have never known him to deliberately mislead a court or mislead the prosecutor. And in fact, I think through his conduct in this case, and you look at his questioning, Yeah. the impression I formed is that every waking moment the jury was in the courtroom and they were staring at the
I don't think that's been the case. Although I will, I can say to the court that I wasn't in the courtroom every moment on the guilt phase. The defendants complained that on the impeachment of the defendant's mother, Jane White, and I would relate that in that particular case, this is Francis Scully Rogers, called Gene White to stand, and after some initial questioning, asked that she be found, but asked that she be able to lead that witness, leading questions, because of her close association with the defendant, the mother. And that was granted. And as the questioning went on, it was an important point to be made, in which Gene White had previously said that she told her son that she was going to call the police for the incident he was tied before he tied her up. And she didn't quite remember it that way when Mrs. Rogers was questioning her. So Mrs. Rogers asked her to listen to the tape, see if it would refresh her memory. The defense counsel asked, well, let's not just play part of the tape, let's play the whole tape so we have it in context. And the tape was played. The tape did provide that Mrs. White had said, you know, I told them I was going to call the police, although she didn't quite even agree with that when she heard the tape. But that was a legitimate examination of Mrs. White on an important point. Another thing that is made of in terms of the prosecutor's conduct is that the prosecutor was asked by, or asked one of the witnesses to define what the slang term tap means. The defendant had heard say he was going to tap the ass of the police officer and tried to stop him. And that witness said, well, I've heard this slang term used. They asked him what context. Well, I hear police officers use it. Sometimes gang members use it. And we think that that was a legitimate question, is to define what the term cap meant for the jury, and not an evidence in any way linked to the defendant of gangs. We never tried to do that. There was a complaint that the term coward had been applied to the defendant by Mrs. Frances Cody Rogers. It is true that she did use that term, but it was justified in the field going to the issues of intent, including going to the issue of the defendant's motive. The motive for this killing, basically, is the defendant feared going to prison. He had that day violated the terms of his probation. He did not want to go to prison. He was so afraid of going to prison, that's why he tied his mother up. That's why he tied his sister up, so that they wouldn't report him. And that is why he took a relatively minor prison sentence that he might have faced and turned it into a death penalty case. Why he shot the officer, he did not fear going to prison. I think the evidence supports that the characterization of the defendant being a coward, and certainly his actions in shooting the police officer, came up unarmed and then injured, shoots him in the back. That's further evidence that the evidence supported that term. The complaint that I had commented on the unsworn testimony of the defendant. The defendant did take a stand in mitigating the sentence that faced this case. A large portion of the mitigation that was attempted to prove here came from Dr. Smith. He said, again, he had systemic disorder and substance abuse. And the history that the defendant gave to Dr. Smith was, my father was abusive, my mother has rejected me, and when I was in the Navy in Hawaii, my life was, and Newport was killed in an auto accident. And then I lost in the Navy because I didn't do something right in that regard, like this injury happened, this death happened. Well, from our standpoint, we proved that he had never been married, that this accident was his excuse, that it never happened. We had flown in representatives from the police department in Hawaii, checked those records,
what had happened is he had talked to Dr. Sunbury, he had talked to Dr. Smith, he had talked to their assistants, giving histories, and the histories of the dates of his alleged marriage and the dates of the alleged death were all over the board. In fact, he had, in one instance, listed the date of his child's birth after the date of the child's death. So he just kept missing it all over. He had the opportunity to give an unsworn statement. This became a large issue in this case, and really went to the credibility and reliability of Dr. Smith's report. On his unsworn statement, the defendant asked the judge, not on his conduct of January 19th, when he shot the police officer, but on the basis of his whole life. He wanted to be judged on the basis of what his life was before January 19th and what his life was after January 19th. Well, this unsworn statement, he could have clarified whether he was married, whether that was a true statement or a false statement. Maybe used it to justify his alcoholism. He did. I did comment on the fact that he did not enlighten us on that position. Because that, when he had the opportunity to talk to the jury for his life, one would think that he would bring that issue to bear. He ignored it completely. I did comment on it. I thought it was justified by him inviting us to judge him on his whole life. If I was wrong, it certainly wasn't prejudicial. I was only telling the jury what they saw for themselves.
You've used your time, Mr. Sandman.
Thank you.
Mr. Bodine, you've stayed a little over 4 minutes of your time.
Counsel, let's say we disagree with the trial judge and grant the motion to enlarge the record about the photographs and the clothing. In light of the fact that no one can disagree if my shot the police officer and you're only disagreeing as to intent, how is that prejudicial?
It becomes prejudicial, Your Honor. Excuse me. On guilt phase issues, one, because there was a legitimate challenge again to the principal charge of aggravation based on the prosecution. There were issues of culpability granted within the rubric of the murder crimes. And I think it certainly impacts upon the mitigation phase. Even if this court is willing to find the middle as mitigation, you still have to consider what impact all of that, the trial tactics and the incredible amount of emotion that was injected in this trial tactics on the jury. That's the importance of this court consistently saying don't over prosecute these cases. I mean, I don't think those words are intended to be hollow. You've got a good case, stick to the evidence. There's no need to do this. There's too great of a risk that those jurors are not going to be looking at the issues that really have to be decided in the capital murder trial. When we're dealing with the death penalty, we should expect less. I want to leave the court with one important principle, and in the history of our constitutional jurisprudence, this court and the United States Supreme Court, the right to a fair trial has never, ever been properly subjected to a balancing analysis based on apparent guilt of the defendant. Never. Gray against Mississippi, Turner against Louisiana, Frazier against the United States, I can go on. If there is any doubt that even one juror was biased, then the structural integrity of the capital trial process has been compromised, and the matter has to be remanded to the trial court for a new trial. This is true, in the words of the United States Supreme Court in Turner, regardless of the heinousness of the crime charged, the apparent guilt of the offender, or the station of life which he occupies. There is a serious question about whether Juror Shepard has biased in this case.
But they also have said that a fair trial doesn't mean a perfect trial, haven't they?
That's true, Your Honor, but those are also in the context of issues beyond fairness of the individual jurors, except that one most fundamental bedrock principle.
Is there really any question here at all about his guilt?
I think there's certainly a question about guilt as it relates to prior calculation and design component. Certainly. Again, I emphasize that the intoxication instruction isn't necessarily a way to
defend. But we start with guilt. There's no question about that he committed this act, is there?
There is no question, Your Honor.
Okay, so then we're down to prior calculation, design, and jury prejudice. How about the B3 thing? Anything from B3 for you, or do you concede waiver?
No, Your Honor, I'm going to concede waiver because even if it doesn't rise to the level of B3, it's certainly proposing to B7. So, again, I'm concerned about the jury prejudice component. We do not subject fair trial Sixth Amendment issues to harm their analysis ever.
Counsel,
there is bias.
Counsel, I realize you've argued that we don't try to get into the mind of how the defense counsel arranges or prioritizes the work injuries. But absent any indication that counsel looked at this and said, trial judge is making what you say, you can keep me off the bus, or I was entitled to it, but the application. Maybe four cars and six motors, but here's Jerry.
Thanks for the indication submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
No.